Your SteveJonesShow.com podcast audio is loading now. Today's SteveJonesShow.com podcast audio is sponsored by Purdy Insurance, Market Street, Sunbury, and online at PurdyInsurance.com.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
And welcome. Great to have you with us. Today's show brought to you by Purdy Insurance, Market Street in Sunbury. Go to PurdyInsurance.com. Great to have you with us on this Monday. Kevin is off sunning himself somewhere. He was able to get this great coupon deal and go to Antarctica. Bob Buhner is in the house.
Hey, Steve. Glad to be here. Apparently, Kevin is in the man cave with the tanning lights on him so he can claim he was at the beach.
He needs that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He looks like a little bit of a... Ooh. What's Chaos. The word? When you untanned one, I guess. And Sarah is here at the controls.
I am.
Sarah, in charge.
Yeah, exactly.
Finally, one sane person in the group. All right. It's been an interesting day, Bob.
It has been, Steve. A long-awaited report from the Attorney General of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, Catherine Kane, was released at a 10:30 press conference in Harrisburg. Some startling revelations came out of that report, and the most startling of which is that despite her campaign vow and beliefs that there was political influence in the prosecution and timing of the prosecution of Jerry Sandusky, there's absolutely no evidence to show that that occurred.
Yeah, there are no emails at all in this that they can find. They poured through a lot of them, and that angle's out of it. But weren't there other elements of this, Bob, that certainly can be called into question, including because of the delay, they found two others that came forward?
Well, that's what Ms. Kane said at the press conference at the very end, right before she literally stopped taking questions and her press spokesman came forward and shut down the press conference. However, Steve, that allegation that in, I think, September of 2009, there were incidents from two victims reported that they had been somehow assaulted by Mr. Sandusky while the investigation was underway was refuted very strongly by the in-court prosecutor, Joe McGettigan, and the kind of the quarterback of the whole prosecution team, Frank Fina, that said they're not aware of anybody that fits that description. They were aware of most of the victims, if not all of the victims, and they do not know what she's talking about. And I'd have to go with McGettigan and Fina since they were the ones who successfully prosecuted Mr. Sandusky in the courtroom. The other takeaway, Steve, from all of this is the length of the investigation and some investigation differences of opinions among prosecutors. But my takeaway was that the Pennsylvania State Police, in the first 12 months of the investigation, did little or next to nothing to advance it. And telling that the state police would not allow the local investigators from the state police who were out in the Lamar Barracks and over in the Bowlesbury Barracks to be interviewed by the Attorney General's office relative to this report. They refused adamantly. And that was that to me. Go ahead.
Can I ask you, though? I thought there were, if I had to pick out two red flags where it stood out to me right away, mm-hmm. obviously it was the statement I just talked about, and that is the one where they found two victims during the so-called slow time or waiting time or lag time. That's one. But the other one was that they elected not to inform Penn State.
Well, is that question, and what the investigators were seeking was information that might have been in the personnel files or within the campus records of reports of Sandusky doing improper things with young people. The investigators claimed that in 2010 they did make contact with Penn State Police and State College Police, And we're told they had nothing in the files, which is actually accurate. Okay. And so, they left it at that. The big issue, though, Steve, was the...
Go ahead. When we're talking about a potential, and again, let's use the word potential in that moment, a potential threat to the community, why wouldn't you inform Penn State or at least the police department of that?
For fear that the that they would somehow in some way, maybe even certainly inadvertently tip off Sandusky that he was, you know, under very serious investigation. And the big decision they had, Steve.
But he is a retired employee.
Yes,
I mean he's not even on the employment rolls at Penn State. He's a retired employee, thus considered to be. I mean, independent. I mean, to me, anybody who's retired is considered independent at that point. Wouldn't you want the State College and Penn State Police to at least be aware of any suspicious activity?
Well, the answer to that, I think, is a little more complex. Although he was a retired employee of the university, he was not a typical retired employee. Remember, he had emeritus status. He still had access to all the facilities. He was there. And in the football building, he was there attending at programs. He was on the campus quite often. So although, yes, retired, that was more of a technical status than the fact that he was there so often and had constant interaction with people at Penn State.
But actually, his retirement agreement was very specific, Bob. Very specific. He was allowed to have a phone in an office in East Building and was allowed to use the workout facilities in East Building.
Right.
He was actually, according to the agreement, as I read it, was restricted to those areas in terms of his on-campus activity, which, as you and I both know, was not enforced.
Exactly. And so he was able to have the full run of the campus, and no one ever... You know, remember that the Jerry Sandusky we think of now, this evil, convicted pedophile who will spend the rest of his life in prison, is not the guy back in 2008. He was considered by many in the community as this amazing man with his second mile program that was helping thousands of youth in central Pennsylvania. He was regarded as an incredible defensive coordinator who, when given the choice between coaching football or working with children and improving their lives, chose to work with children. That was a perception in the community. And one of the themes of the prosecutors who were under the microscope in this analysis, Steve, was that if they were going to go after and successfully prosecute Sandusky, they had to have lots of evidence, and that evidence had to be corroborated, meaning they had to have multiple victims, which is one of the reasons why they took their time to discover these other victims. And it all came about the next stage of the investigation in 2010 when Stacy Parks Miller, the now district attorney of Center County, received an anonymous email saying that she might want to speak with a guy named Mike McQuarrie. And she immediately passed that on to the attorney general's office, which, as we know, what that led to, and the discovery of other victims. The big controversy from the press conference, and a guy by the name of Jeff Moulton, who I've met as part of the interview process for his report, was whether they should have gone with a search warrant at Sandusky's house sooner rather than later.
Right.
That was the big question for that he brought out about the investigation. And his take on it was reasonable prosecutors can differ on when to do that. The reluctance to do it early was because they didn't want to tip off Sandusky, and if in the affidavit of probable cause for the search warrant, they would have to lay out all the reasons why they suspected him. So they didn't want to tip him off. They didn't know what they would find or how fruitful it would be. So they decided until not late, but almost at the 11th hour to go with the search warrant. And what they found was a lot of information from the second mile with lists of children's name, and some of them had asterisks beside them. Those asterisks led them to investigate the names, and that's where they found multiple victims.
All right. Now, this is going to be a very difficult question because it's a judgment question.
Sure.
Okay. In your role as a district attorney, as a prosecutor, how many victims did you feel comfortable taking a case like this forward? I mean, was there a certain number that you had in mind?
Yeah, there actually, Steve, that there was in my mind. 3 to 4.
Once you get to 3 to 4, you as a prosecutor now felt you had a concrete basis to take a case forward.
Yes, and I want to qualify that slightly. Sometimes when you have one victim and you have enough corroboration and another outside information to support all of that, then, you know, one victim is fine. But in a situation like this where you're looking at the caliber of the person that you would be prosecuting and knowing what the reaction of the community might be, one young child from a troubled background versus a community icon who could bring in a legion of people to testify as to that person's character, you better have victims who are independent of each other, that one would not know the next one who would know the next one who would know the next one, so that a reasonable juror back in the jury room is going to go, you know, maybe one, possibly two, but wait a minute, three? No way. These kids did not get together. The pattern of behavior is so consistent, as it was in the Sandusky case. The lines used, the manner of enticement, the social isolation involved, among three or four disparate individuals who could not be in any way logically connected or coerced into coming up with that common scheme. That's what you're looking for, especially given who you're prosecuting.
How difficult is this case, this kind of case?
It's unbelievable.
For you as a prosecutor.
Unbelievably difficult.
Especially considering the crime, well, the difficulty of talking about the crime and the age of the individuals involved.
And the other part of that is, even the best child interview that you have before a trial is completely different than putting a young 12-year-old child on the witness stand in front of 12 strangers and a judge in a courtroom where people are wearing black robes, where there's a stenographer taking every word down. It's even a normal person going into a courtroom to just give their name, rank, and serial number can be a pretty daunting test. For just the basics, let alone trying to talk about the most intimate personal details of one's private life at that age. So if you can get the young children to get of the mindset that, and this is what I used, Steve, when I was prosecuting cases, I would say to them, do you have a brother and a sister? Yes. Would you want this person to do to your brother or sister what they did to you? No, I wouldn't. Well, now you need to help us because we want to make sure that no one ever has to go through what you went through. Can you help me on that? Are you willing to do that to help your brothers, your sisters, your friends? And usually the kids would agree. And viewing it from that perspective was helpful. But it's still a gamble when you put a child on the witness stand, how they're going to relate and what the jurors' reactions will be. So it is difficult.
I still go back to the Penn State part of it. Now, okay, maybe not informing the university, but informing the police department. Mm-hmm. Don't you think, I mean, that's the part that struck me, that wouldn't you want the police departments, at least in this area, to be very much aware that, hey, look.
Now, that's not how not how law enforcement works, especially the Pennsylvania State Police. I can tell you that
why doesn't it work that way? Wouldn't you want to have them aware that, hey, look, if a child comes to you and says, hey, X may have done this to me, okay, hey, I've been informed that it's a possibility, so now we're okay, instead of being like having them pass it off.
The Pennsylvania State Police are minimalist when it comes to sharing information with local law enforcement. That is across the board. That's the way they do things. I can tell you, it gets very frustrating at times for folks like myself and my fellow prosecutors. I think there are good reasons for that, but there are also some bad reasons. And
I'm just coming at it from a common sense point of view.
Yep.
I'm not coming at this as someone with inside knowledge, because they may have a great reason why they don't. I would just like them to tell it to me so I knew.
Yeah. And Steve, always that's very frustrating, but that's just the way the state police are in Pennsylvania. They've been that way historically.
Well, like I said, there may be a great reason for it. I'd be open-minded to listen as to what the reason is.
Yeah,
but
and I can tell you in the next when we're talking more about this after the break about some other things that occurred that actually surprised me in this whole thing.
Okay. Bob Buehner with us. We also are going to talk a little bit about football recruiting.
And welcome you back to the Steve Jones Show here on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Brought to you by Purdy Insurance, Street in Sunbury.
What a great segue.
PurdyInsurance.com. Yes.
Excellent, Steve. Boy, did you hit that one.
Purdy. Love Purdy's.
Yeah, great people.
Market Street in Sunbury. Yeah, yeah. Market Street in Sunbury. Go to PurdyInsurance.com. And we're going to take advantage of having Bob here today. We're going to put the recruiting segment with Greg Pickle back to tomorrow. So we're going to take advantage of having Bob here today because there's a lot of things to talk about. From the trademark ruling with the Redskins to what we talked about today with Kathleen Kam.
Yeah.
Let's get to the Redskins thing first. So we just talked about the press conference today. In fact, let's reverse that. There was something that stuck out to you today in the press conference and that you wanted to get to. Let's get to that first, then the Redskins.
Steve, this report that was released today is over 330 pages. 140 or 50 pages are the report itself, and then there's plenty of appendices with notable emails, things of that nature attached.
Right.
I did not realize until today the extent to which Penn State fought tooth and nail to prevent information from being released to the grand jury. There were things like motions to quash the subpoenas from the grand jury that went on. It took something like a year and a half before Penn State finally started releasing information from the time it was requested. And the 18 months is just a guesstimate on my part. But I didn't realize that there was inside this grand jury investigation was a major skirmish between Cynthia Baldwin, who at that time was the general counsel for Penn State, a former member of the Board of Trustees, former chairman of the board, and a former appointed justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, who sparred with the Attorney General's office and fought to prevent the subpoenas from being issued. She ultimately lost, and the irony of that is, of course, she comes forward and appears in front of the grand jury as a witness and in certain ways implicates President Spanier, the Vice President Schultz, and Athletic Director Curley, and there's all these issues swirling around about attorney-client privilege and who was she representing and who in front of the grand jury. But she fought on behalf of Penn State to keep things quiet for a long time. And I didn't know that battle was going on right below the surface. No one ever reported on that until this report came out.
Right, so that's in this report.
Yes. That to me was startling. The issue, let me back up. The gentleman who was commissioned by the Attorney General, his name is Jeff Moulton, a former federal prosecutor from the Philadelphia area, a professor of law at the Widener School of Law, no political agenda whatsoever. I believe he was the first assistant United States attorney in Philadelphia at the time a Republican was in office as the U.S. attorney, in other words, his boss. But the guy has impeccable credentials. And what his take on it was this. There's no evidence of any political shenanigans going on in the Sandusky case. And he broke the investigation down into four stages. Stage one was the report came out of Central Mountain High School in Lock Haven, reported to Children and Youth by the school district. They might have done it better, but they certainly complied with the law. CYS started its investigation, notified the state police, and then the Children and Youth of Clinton County in Lock Haven interviewed Sandusky. The state police never showed up for that interview. It was determined by the district attorney of Clinton County, a guy by the name of Mike Salisbury, who's now a judge, that from the information the victim number one who came forward related, that almost all of the alleged acts, and I use that alleged at the time they were alleged acts, did not occur in Clinton County. They occurred over in Center County. So he shifted the case over to the district attorney then, Mike Madeira, who it turns out, Mr. Madeira Sandusky's wife was connected to the Sandusky family.
Right.
And he felt...
So he recused himself and sent it to the Attorney General.
Yeah, and that was about a 5 or 6 month period. The Attorney General's office, working with the state police and one of their own investigators, that became phase two. It got to the point where in phase two, the prosecutor assigned to this case, a lady by the name of Janelle Eshball, and I know Janelle, she drafted an indictment based on the grand jury testimony of victim number one, and there was only one victim at the time. And she was told by her superiors, as they discussed and debated this within the Attorney General's office, we don't have enough to go after Jerry Sandusky. We need more.
This is all standard practice.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's nothing out of the realm that is nothing that's an absolute straight line as to where you should be.
And what they're saying, Steve, is they all believe there had to be more victims. We just have to find them. And there was a period of downtime in this investigation where nothing happened 4 or 5 months. But the investigators were not still trying to investigate and follow up leads, but they weren't finding anything. Then stage three was Mike McQuarrie, the email about Mike McQuarrie, and that was in November of 10. And then that phase went on.
It was 2 days after the election.
Exactly. And that's when things started to happen. In the last year of the investigation, the grand jury was meeting extensively. There were no less than 50 witnesses subpoenaed. There were no less than 50 subpoenas issued for documents or other types of evidence that would have to be provided by various individuals or businesses. Second Mile was not apparently as cooperative as well as Penn State during this time. But the Attorney General's office was going full speed ahead, which resulted in the November announcement of the arrest of Jerry Sandusky in, I believe, 2011. So
okay. But I want to get to another part of
sure.
this. Okay, and that is who wrote the grand jury summary and why were certain critical words included in that summary that were not in the testimony?
You know, I would say, and I don't know that that's addressed. That's a good point. I think I know who did that.
Let me put it to you this way,
sure.
Okay? Okay, everyone knows the two words I'm thinking of, and those two words do not appear in the testimony.
They do not. Would the two words be sexual assault?
Anal rape.
Okay, yes. There is no evidence of that being ever described in anyone's testimony throughout the entire time the grand jury which issued the presentment. I would think that the grand jury document that was released by the Attorney General with the, what they call the presentment from the grand jury was either drafted by, partly written by, and certainly edited by Frank Fina, who was the supervisor in the Attorney General's office covering the grand jury. Now, having said that, there was one person below him, the line prosecutor, her name Janelle Eshball. She's the one who interviewed not very well, mind you, Coach Paterno when he went into the grand jury. Very confusing, to say the least, her questions. And then when Eshball to Frank Fina, who is a practiced law in Lewisburg and was an assistant DA in Union County for a while, he had a boss named Rick Sheets, who was head of the criminal division. Sheets reported to the first assistant, Bill Ryan, who then reported to Tom Corbett. So the connection from the line prosecutor all the way up to the Attorney General was four steps in between. And I would think that Frank Fina, as the head guy for the grand jury, who very successfully prosecuted all the politicians in Harrisburg in what was known as Bonus Gate, two speakers of the House, all types of Democrats, Republicans in the House of Representatives, and all their staff members, probably up to 20 people. That's the guy doing this. And I know they were exceedingly busy. The Sandusky case was not the only case on the pile. They had these incredible other difficult prosecutions involving some of the top political leaders in Pennsylvania going on at about the same time. But Fina probably wrote or edited that, and he would have had to sign off on it before we went up to his boss and his boss's boss and then ultimately Attorney General Corbett.
But that part's not accurate.
It is not. And I thought during the Sandusky trial that the defense lawyers for Sandusky, Amendola, and a guy who just surrendered his law license because he embezzled $500,000 or so of clients' money from the, he's from the Harrisburg area, whose name just momentarily escapes me. I thought that was information so ripe for cross-examination at trial that you could put it up on a bulletin board and show the jury and then put up next to it the actual testimony, and you could cast a lot of doubt on the Attorney General's whole case based on things like that. It never really happened.
Right. Right. Well, here's the problem with that. And I don't want to indict the media on this.
Sure.
Because when you're trying to turn over stories quickly, all right, what happens is unfortunately 9.5 times out of 10, you take the summary and you do your story off the summary. The Free Report was a perfect example.
Oh.
Jeremy Schapp got on there and went breathlessly through the summary, and then when you read the report, it doesn't quite match the summary.
Exactly.
And in this case, the summary doesn't quite match all the testimony.
Especially on something critical like that.
Critical like that.
Yes.
Right? So, you know, and what happens is, well, boom, 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 and everyone's assuming. You got to the point where you sat back and went, did anybody sit down and take the time to read this thing?
Yeah, and I can tell you, like, for today, I did not see all. I read a substantial part of it. I'm a pretty fast reader. I have not had a chance to fully digest 330 pages yet. But the media, this was released a little ahead of time. The media stories on this press conference, which started at 10:30, were the news media, including the print media from Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and Harrisburg, were already issuing stories at 10:35. So they had an advanced copy. They knew what it was going to say, and they took their leads, not waiting to hear what the press conference said. And then they'd run kind of like corrections or annotations to that
as
the day goes on. But the big issue here, if you go back, I think the question about the state police for the first year when they were supposedly in charge of this investigation really leads a lot to be answered. And the fact that the state police would not allow their troopers involved in this to even be interviewed by the Attorney General's office is also not only telling but shocking. And I think this goes on and on.
But isn't this, as you said, you need 3 to 4 to be comfortable with it.
Yeah.
Isn't this a hard case to investigate? I'm trying to be fair here.
No,
isn't
it is.
Isn't this a hard case to investigate when you're trying to find the other two to four as a possibility? Because it's hard to get, because you're really trying not to say, hey, Billy, do you know Bob?
Well, the one thing that one of the investigators finally did, after too long of a delay, was read the Jerry Sandusky book and started looking at the names of children from the second mile. It was, you know, it's one of those things you hate to say, but it was out there in plain view the whole time. But maybe, you know, listen, as this Jeff Moulton, the guy who did the report, said today, you know, hindsight is certainly 20/20, and when you can see the whole picture after it's been done, it's very easy to connect the dots now. And so that was, I think, a really important comment. And he was being infinitely fair over this with the media when he was answering the questions. It was Catherine Kane who had these canned responses to all the questions she was asked.
Right.
It was very interesting. He was going into substantive areas, and she was repeating whatever talking points her staff put together for her prior to the news conference.
Sure.
And I understand that. Right. That's sometimes you have to be prepared.
Right. Right. And I understand that. I have no issue with that at all. You get to page 339 of this report, which is the last page. And I think this is under the, let's see, maybe it's under, I don't know if it's under corrections or at least, okay. The judge considered the extensive documentation that the organization had provided. The second mile did not delay the investigation, it says.
Yep.
It responded to every request for information on or before the date on which the information was requested. Page 72 and 126, following the phone call cited in Item 1, Jack Rakovics.
He was the head of the second mile.
Head of the second mile. Learned that Sandusky in November of 2008, that Sandusky was being investigated. As per second mile policy, Sandusky was immediately separated from the youth program. It also says that Rakovics met with Tim Curley in 2001. Okay, Tim Curley told Rakovics that someone, and no one is named as the someone, was made uncomfortable. We know who that person is now. Mm-hmm. Was made uncomfortable by Sandusky being in a university shower with a youth. Now, that's how it's termed.
Yes.
Curley stated that the incident was investigated and no sexual misconduct was alleged or found. With regard to the 1998 investigation of Sandusky, no individual organization, government agency contacted the Second Mile or Rakovics about an investigation of Sandusky. Okay.
Yes.
So, there are so many twists and turns in this where Tim Curley at least informed the agency, obviously, of what was going on.
Absolutely. I think Curley, of anybody, and will ultimately be decided in the court of law, I think, but he was kind of trying to pass on information to people to make them aware of what they knew, and it seemed that it was just met with kind of tone-deaf responses. And then, of course, in all of this, we have a missing district attorney in 2005 who was at the center of the 1998 child in the shower incident.
And elected not to prosecute based on the evidence he had.
Exactly.
Bob in Watsontown has questions. Hi, Bob.
I don't have as many questions as I do opinion. I just think our state police, our borough, in the area and in Pennsylvania alone, I just don't think they're not very good at doing their jobs. This was brought to their attention, and like you said, if the state police don't want to share information with the borough police and other police, that's just crazy. When you do an investigation, you want as much information you can get before you set somebody's name up to some allegations like that. Because, face it, I'm a middle-aged man and you're just accused of something like that, there's no erasing that in the public's eye.
Bob, I couldn't agree with you more. I had a policy in my 20-year term that I never commented on an investigation or even acknowledged there was an investigation, and I would tell the media if the investigation results and my belief that there's a crime committed and a person was responsible, you'll know about it because the person will be investigated. And if it doesn't meet that standard, you're not going to hear from me on it because I don't want to put that person's name out there because they're never going to get their reputation back. And that always bothered me.
Right. That's a big part. But one thing about the state police, Bob.
Yes.
You know, it's really difficult when you're investigating something as trying to figure out who's telling the truth and who's not. And that's so difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who do you believe?
Well, I've had several incidents with the state police as far as one where just calling them to come out because people were going by a bus stop and going too fast.
Right.
No response. I've had there was a break-in at my neighbor's house. They called. They said that no, they weren't busy that night. There'd be officer by within the hour. It was 2.5 hours later. There's another incident. I don't know if you've heard about the one out here in Watsontown where the man and the wife, the man ended up shooting his wife.
Yep, know that one.
Did you hear that? Now, doesn't that seem a little crazy? There's only two people that were involved. And at the first call 2 years ago, they said that there was an intruder. There was never an intruder. It was just whether it was a mistaken identity, whatever, but it was two individuals. Wife ended up getting shot, and it took 2 years now for the state police to bring this man up on charges.
I'm very familiar with that and knew about it right when it happened and quite surprised
that
it took
down the road
for
me.
Yeah, it took 2 years to get it. To the point of an arrest. Those are baffling things. That's under, obviously it's in the court system now.
Yeah. And I have an incident right now where some friends at work are going through a divorce and some cars were were actually scrapped, and this guy's 6 months, and the person that did it admitted to it, and it took 6 months for them to actually, you know, get her into court just for so she could plead guilty or not guilty. And there was, I mean, there's been so many. I mean, I work with guys, and we've had certain incidents, and it's just, it's unbelievable how slow the state police are to work. And then when you call and ask for information, they almost act like you're the person. You know what I mean? Or you're the one doing the crime. I have no faith in the state police nowadays, and some of the borough police. You know what? The only time I think nowadays, and I've told this to several people, the only time you can get them to come out to your place is if you tell them you heard shots. And boy, then they'll bring everybody. You know, other than that, you might as well sit by and wait for hours before anybody shows up. But
there you go.
That's my opinion. You know,
okay.
That's my opinion on our,
okay.
Okay. Our people that are supposed to serve and protect us. You know,
okay,
so.
We'll see. Yeah, some communities don't have local police anymore. They have to cover it. So.
Yeah. Well, this thing with Sandusky, too, it was 10 years or better, and then all of a sudden, when these things came, they ran him. I mean, I think the guy's guilty, not defending him, but, boy, they ran that trial through and in and out, and, boy, he's in, you know, in jail and done. It was like, okay, guys, we dropped the ball. Now let's get, you know.
No, I don't know that that's fair to say it that way, because once the person is arrested, and that was in November, I think the trial occurred in the summertime, like August, and there are lots.
June.
I'm sorry. Yeah,
it was in June.
In a case of that magnitude, with the number of witnesses and all the pretrial motions, that was a fairly fast time of trial, but it wasn't so fast that it was rushed. And
let me put you this way. How about if I phrase it this way,
okay.
Bob?
Go ahead.
Okay. When you have an alleged predator, mm-hmm. and you have what you think are enough witnesses, it is then important to have the trial, determine guilt or innocence, and if determined guilty, get the predator off the streets as quickly as possible. The other part, which is the part that's still out there, you can take your time to figure that part out, because those aren't the predators.
Right, right.
Okay. How about that, Bob? Is that fair?
Yeah, that's really good, Steve. I agree with you.
Yeah.
Then you have the two Penn State officials that they feel, I mean, the law enforcement evidently feels that they've done wrong. Now, we don't know if they have or not, but it's going on how many years now, and they haven't even seen the inside of a courtroom yet. I mean, if they know about this and did cover it up, I think you talked earlier that sometimes these people are just as guilty as the person doing the crime.
Well, not in this case. One of the things, Bob, you have to look at is risk, you know, danger to the community. I don't think the three Penn State administrators are in any way a danger to the community.
Right.
Now, did they make a failure in judgment? That'll be determined by a jury and a judge. But they're not a threat like a Jerry Sandusky.
Right, and that's the point I was trying to make. The predator's the threat to the community. The other parts you can take your time with, because they are not. Okay. Thank you so much, Bob. Appreciate it. Bob Buter stays with us in the house.
All right.
To talk about the Redskins, which I think it's a different topic.
Yes.
But we're going to talk about that as well. Coming up on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Today's show brought to you by Purdy Insurance, Market Street in Sunbury on News Radio 1070 WKOK.